So thank you all for coming tonight on this Easter Sunday. Forsaking ham and turkey dinners for Buddha Dharma. Is there anybody who is first time here tonight? Oh, okay. So our usual procedure is to, before the formal talk begins, to see if anybody has any questions. Questions about the practices that were done here tonight, the meditation practices, mindfulness practice, or more general questions that anybody may have, new or old, about practice in general, mindfulness in general, Buddhism in general, and the application of it to daily life, situations of daily life that may be somewhat problematic or difficult for people. So we begin there, and then afterwards we move into the formal talk. So having said that, does anybody have any questions? Yes.
Hi,
Gary. Hey, Gary.
How are you?
I'm good.
Well, I don't know that I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
But since I think the last interview you shared, we kept saying, for a swim is already sure.
Mm-hmm.
I've been all over the place with that since that night. You can sort of internally.
So, for those who are new, for the past month, 6 weeks, I've been teaching from these this book of calligraphy by Thich Nhat Hanh, which are very short, just several word teachings. But I've been presenting them as pith teachings, meaning they are very short, but they're very powerful to wake us up and transform us. So one of the ones we did was, "Are you sure?" And go on. So Gary, you're saying it's... I mean, being all over the place, meaning in a good way, or?
It's not good or bad. It's just aware that it's been so slippery for me. I wasn't able to remember the next morning. I kept a whole drama about using a credit card here. It's just since then, I just had a slippery relationship with that saying. So I would like you to talk more about it.
Can you give me a better sense of what's slipping for you?
I don't
So it's just a morass you've fallen into.
It has an oasis, like it just disappears. I'm aware.
Here it is, Gary.
Thank you.
Are we clear now?
You're
Are you sure you're clear? So again, just very simply stated, I mean, it's a very powerful, on multiple levels, the profundity of this. I mean, at the... at the simplest level of our ordinary projections and about people or situations, where we think we know what's going on with somebody or not going on with somebody or what the story is, or you know what I mean, just kind of moving that self-statement that we make to ourselves, which often can rigidifies us in some sort of view of life or another person, can create all types of emotionalities around it. Just that simple capacity of looking at that perception and just saying to oneself, am I sure that's true? Am I sure? Before I act as if it's absolutely true, before I speak as if it's absolutely true, and before I create all kinds of emotionality and drama as if it's true, just to stop and ask oneself, am I sure that the way I'm perceiving the situation, the person, is true? And just that capacity, right, to self-reflect. And, in many, many cases come up with the answer of, maybe I'm not totally sure. You know? Right then, as opposed to going down that avenue of certainty and self-righteousness and, you know, reification of views, we immediately are doing what? We're creating space. Oh, you know, I may not be absolutely sure that the thing that I think is true is true. And in that opening, there is an opportunity to self-reflect, right? You know, on the nature of one's own perceptions and the nature of one's own mental formation and what may be driving one. Many times we find that what's driving one is our own internal formations, our own reactivity, our own past, as opposed to the situation itself. But it also opens up the possibility of, so if I'm, you know, if I think Alex did something because of something or other, right? And if I'm willing to ask myself, am I sure that's what happened? Am I sure that's what's going on with him? Am I sure that's what he said? Am I sure that's what he meant? I mean, so first I can check myself, you know, my own projections. But then it may cause me to do this incredibly, unusual thing. I may actually ask Alex. I may communicate to Alex, you know, and communicate to him, asking him the question. You know, I thought this, is this what you said? Is this what you meant? Is this where you were coming from? You know what I'm saying? It all of a sudden, rather than always, like so many of us do, we play all parts in our drama, right? I mean, not only do I play my part, but I play the other person's part, right? I mean, I know what they're thinking, I know their views, I know what they did, do what they did. You know, we're just, we are the creators of our drama and we are in control of all the participants. So are you sure, in a very simple way, kind of opens that all up. It makes it open. And it makes everything, we could say, a hypothesis. Right? Thoughts are just, perceptions are just, beliefs are just hypothesis. Right? And hypotheses always need to be tested with what? Reality. Right. You know, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, you know, life unfolds in reality and not in our thoughts about reality. Because we know as long as we think life is unfolding in my thoughts about reality, I'm lost. Right? We're all lost. Because our thoughts are all over the place, as Gary is attesting, right? Our thoughts are all over the place, right? We can think of this and we can think that. And you spend a few days just watching your mind, you realize your mind is all over the place, right? And not only is all the place, it's capable of holding totally contradictory ideas, within 5 minutes of each other, right? So, if you had a witness up on the stand who was all over the place like that, you would not consider that person a reliable witness, right? Would you? They're totally contradicting themselves, they're all over the place, they free associate, right? You wouldn't consider that a reliable witness, to base testimony on. But yet we take this endlessly unfolding all over the place. We're in the past, we're in the future, we're a 5-year-old, we're an adult, we're we're back being a 14-year-old. You know what I mean? We're just, right? So, it doesn't mean that kind of unfolding may not be occurring within our minds, but are you sure lets us kind of have some distance from the unfolding and to be capable of just asking the question. And the best question is, to check it out in reality. Which then opens us up to the viewpoints of others. Right? Oh, could it be that if I have a mind like this, maybe the other person has a mind like this. Very interesting, right? So it opens up dialogue, communication, capacity for understanding. Right? It's a very open and testing way to move through reality. And there's a bit of humility in it. Right? It's sort of the opposite of what? The way most of us run life, which is what? You know, most of our mantra is what? I am sure. Right? I'm sure that I'm right, I'm true, my perceptions are correct, my take on you is absolutely right, you know, right? My political beliefs, totally true, my social beliefs, totally true, right? Psychologically, you know, right? I am sure. So most of us, this is a wonderful mantra teaching to take down the, you know, most of us have that calligraphy unconsciously on our wall, I am sure, right? And we replace it with, are you sure? So it's, you know, again, if we've always lived in surety, then it could be a little disconcerting. Because it, again, it, you know, depends how deep you want to take this practice, and it can be a very deep practice. Because ultimately, at you know, the deepest level with this mantra is, am I really sure of anything? Right? I mean, and you know Buddhist teaching gets at the very heart of our surety, right? Because the Buddhist teaching says, you know, things that totally pull out the rug from our sense, right? Because, you know, I mean, we think things are permanent, and the Buddhist teaching says, no, nothing's permanent. Everything's impermanent. Nothing lasts. Everything is changing moment to moment. There's nothing, right? We think things are solid, right? Everything is solid and unto itself. The Buddhist teaching says, no, everything is just made up of parts. Parts are just made of parts. Everything is interconnected, just endless variables affecting and you know reaffecting each other and as well as self. Self doesn't exist in any inherent way. Other doesn't exist in an inherent way. There's no, and you know, even further, there's no birth, there's no death. I mean it, right? So if you want the capacity to say, am I sure about anything, I say the Buddhist teaching very deeply tells us, don't be sure about anything. Right. Now, what is the other side of that? Is realization, right? Where one develops the insight, both intellectually, as well as directly intuitively, into things what you can be sure. You know. So, what is it? Can I be sure about? In a certain way, the realm of conceptualization, the realm of thought, the realm of projection, etc. You know, the seeming appearance of the world as solid, as permanent, etc. And, you know, I can't be sure any of that is that way. So what can I be sure about, right? Well, we can always be sure about this. Right? This moment. Just as it is, if we are totally present to it, we can be sure that we have the capacity to be here. So if somebody says to you, Gary, are you sure you're here? Gary can say what? Yes, I am here. I see you. I hear you. Right? I am sure of this present reality. Right? But if somebody says, are you sure it's going to be this way a minute from now, Gary would say, no, I'm not sure of that. Because he may also be sure about what? Impermanence. Things aren't solid. You know, are you sure that you're a self and I'm a self? And you might say, no, I'm actually sure we're not. Because there is no proof that any of that really exists. So at the same time, in Buddhism, this is called, you know, kind of what's called the relative and the absolute, the conditioned and the unconditioned, you know, all this kind of stuff. Right? So the realm of are you sure relates to the world of relativity, the world of change, the world of conditionality. Well, the realm of surety really relates to that which is true, the unconditioned. But, you know, we start here, and the journey is here. But you know, the mantra, "Are you sure?" allows us to begin to let, you know, in the beginning we grasp this so solidly, you know, we hold on so solidly to our self-identity and who I am and who I was and who I will be and our past and our future and our reputations and our things, you know, we're solid. I'm sure that this will give me happiness, right? But after you get knocked around enough by life, you begin to think, maybe I'm not so sure. Right? And that's, so we begin to get a little more, we get to get a little not so tightly bound. Right? Things begin to open a little bit, stretch a little bit. And then we end up like, you know, what Gary may be is like, he's not here yet, right? But he's no longer here. He's somewhere in here. And we often go in this middle place, you know, where am I? Right? You know? It's sort of like, you know, what's that thing, you know, where you're, you know, you're on the boat getting out on the dock, or you're on the dock and you got 1 foot on one and 1 foot on the other, and all of a sudden, you know, it's sort of like that one. You know, you're kind of, you know, you're not solid yet, right? You're not in the, you know, you're not out of the boat, but you're not on solid land yet. So you kind of, that's okay. I mean, some people get a little disturbed as they begin to leave their moorings, you know, things they always believed were true about themselves and life, you know what I mean? All their touchstones, all their foundation stones. It seems so solid and real, but you know, when they leave those behind and they really haven't got a grounded, deep sense of, you know, of what the path promises, you're kind of in a middle ground, right? You have intimations, you have insights, you have some sense of movement in the right direction, but you're not solid yet. But that's okay. Some people get kind of, they say things like, you know, I'm in a real just confused state, or it's very uncomfortable to them, uncomfortable state. My sense, you know, just frame it as I'm in transition. Right? I'm in transition, right? I started here, I want to get here, and I'm in transition. I'm not sure where I am. I mean, I know when people say to me, you know, I don't know where I am anymore. I don't know where I am. Well, I said, you know where you are. Where am I? You're at a place where you don't know who you are. I mean, that's where you are. Right? Or even if they said, I'm in a state of confusion, okay, well, you know where you are then. What's the big deal? Are you sure? It's wonderful. You know, every time you get stuck, use that mantra. Every time you get stuck in a projection, every time you get stuck in some kind of reification of your own stuff or your relationship to somebody else, and you feel yourself tightening and constricting and obsessing and ruminating, you know what I mean? All that. Are you sure can get you unstuck? And you can relax and open. Well, you know, well, that's the way I see it, but now that I'm kind of looking at that, you know, maybe there's another way to see it. And maybe there's another way to see it, right? And maybe there's another reason why I'm feeling this way or reacting this way, right? Or, again, or, you know, include the other person or other, it becomes a very open. You know, it's like 360. As opposed to usually it's just all very narrow, coming just out of here. Most of our views are self-centered. Everything is coming through the prism of self, which is, as you know, very narrow. Because it's only what? One view. I mean, 6 billion people on this planet, and I'm only one. So I have one view. So, if there are any mathematicians here, we know that's kind of tiny, isn't it? Compared to the other 5 billion-something views? I mean, why is my view all of a sudden the right view? Right? I mean, it just doesn't even make mathematical sense. I mean, I can acknowledge it's my view, but to think that somehow there's truth in it, or absolute truth, or certainty, it's kind of ridiculous, isn't it? So anyhow, enjoy the mantra. Any other questions? Yes.
This isn't a question, just mm-hmm. a commentary for Gary, but mm-hmm. if you look at the page, Gary, and you make one simple change in the mark on the page, it really becomes easy. You change the exclamation point into a question mark.
Mm-hmm. Good. Mm-hmm. Speaking of, when I was here 2 weeks ago, we worked on I Am Here For You. Is that what we worked on? How did, and the other one was I Am Here For You, and then we just did that little one at the end. I am here for you, and the other one was, I know you are there, and I am very happy. Did anybody have any practice or success with that one? I am here for you. And remember we said, for those who weren't here, I said that the same way, you know, are you sure is the opposite of I am sure. I am here for you is the opposite of our usual egocentric, narcissistic way of doing it, which is rather than I am here for you, you are here for me. Right? Which is the usual way we do relationships. You are here for me, to meet my needs. So is anybody practicing I am here for you? Or I know you are there and I am happy? Yes. What is your name?
Chuck.
Chuck, yes, Chuck.
After your talk, I ran across, in one of Thich Nhat Hanh's books, I think the book's called You Are Here. He broke that being here into three parts that I found kind of interesting. He said that you had to be here for yourself first, and that you had to resolve some of the basic issues that you had and be there for yourself before you could be there for your loved ones. And then that was the second step, was to be there for your loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
The third step was to be there for the community and the world. And I thought it was an interesting, it rung with me after your talk.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was a three-part thing that I could see in my life that has been happening.
Right. So just so, because Alex always wants me to repeat the question. So Alex is, Alex, well, your name is Chuck. Chuck doesn't really have a question, but he's saying afterwards he read, reading some book by Thich Nhat Hanh, he kind of broke it down into a developmental model of first you're here for yourself, which means you do your own healing and your development, your capacity to be present to yourself in a meaningful way. Out of that comes the capacity to be there truly for another, and out of that, comes the capacity to truly be present to the world and be of benefit. Good. Yes. Kate.
Is it possible to be doing all three at once? Because I feel like if I spent my whole life working out my little issues,
mm-hmm.
The world might never get any of my attention.
Right. No, I think that's a good point. Right. I mean, we can say it's a developmental model, but on the other hand, things do not, you know, we do not exist in a vacuum. So like, you know, now I'm going to cut myself off from all interactions and just work on myself. Because that will give us a very false sense, right, of where we're at. Because a lot of our stuff, as everybody knows, arises in relationship to other people, right? It's our encounter with the world, the encounter with people and situations, right, that our personal stuff becomes present to us. I mean, many of us, if we lived in a beautiful sylvan setting in the mountains or woods, you know, by the fresh stream and, you know, and had all our needs being met, we may experience ourselves as very peaceful, calm people. And especially if we're doing a lot of loving kindness meditation, I mean, we might think we are the most loving people. I am very peaceful, I am very loving, and, you know, very wise, or, you know what I mean, from that stance. You know, but then we go down into the town, and before you know it, stuff arises. So you're absolutely right. You know, the idea that one works on oneself in isolation isn't correct. But it also, but I think the wisdom is there, is while you are very interactive with the world and using your relationships and experience of the world, you also have an understanding that, you know, it is through your own capacity to see your own stuff in mindfulness and to learn to deal with it and heal it and transform it and et cetera, that are you not only gaining a greater capacity to be there for yourself in a real way, but obviously at the same time you are developing the capacity to be there for another. So it's, and the world. So I think it's a you know, all processes, all those interactions, three stages can go on at three times, but I think the important thing is to know where you're at. Do you know what I mean? And to say, you know, even though, let's say, one, two, three, a third, a third, a third, because I'm where I'm at now, maybe I should really be giving 60 to me right now in 2020 to the other two. But that's all in the service of developing your capacity to eventually make it, you know, 30, 30, 33, 33, 33. And the truth is, actually, as you heal and develop yourself, that need to take care of oneself diminishes, right? So actually what happens is that self-care, you know, can go down to 5 or 1. It becomes very minimal, which means you have what? A lot more available to give to others. But again, you know, we should always be real, right? Which is, I think, most important in this path, and not skip over. Right? So, does that make clear? So, yeah. I mean, does that answer what you were saying?
I keep coming back to making the choice. When the choice is there, do I take this time for myself, or do I help this person that's asking for it right now?
You know, again, Kate, it's a lot of that capacity of responding to others is long-term versus short-term. Right? I mean, if you have a goal of developing a certain capacity within yourself, right, you know that in the short term you may have to be more focused on that, right, and say no to certain things, because your long term goal is to be able to be more out there, but you know you're not there yet, right? So, you know, it's sort of like, you know, when you're in a when you're in an apprenticeship situation, when you're in a learning situation, or being mentored or being trained, right? I mean, you realize, you know, yeah, I could run out there and do something, but, you know, I really don't know what I'm doing, right? So maybe it'd be better, you know, so you're turning away from saying yes or getting engaged is not indifference. It's not selfishness. Do you know what I mean? It's really saying, no, I'm really trying to, you know, develop capacity here. And it's going to take me time. But my goal is to be able to be of greater benefit. You know, does that make sense? So that's why in Mahayana Buddhism, you know, which has the Bodhisattva ideal, which means that the whole basis of practice is to be of benefit to others. Right. I mean, that is 100% of what it's about. But at the same time, it understands that without a certain level of development, personal healing, personal capacity to deepen one's understanding, you know, which involves a lot of perhaps self-healing, one cannot fulfill that mission because one's stuff always gets in the way. And so, it really, Kate, it becomes more just a, you know, it becomes very kind of realistic decision making, as opposed to, you know, so you don't, I mean, you know, when you don't go do something, or you don't respond to a situation, it's not, again, because of selfishness or not caring. It's knowing that, you know, that for you to really heal yourself, that takes some time. But you understand, like I'm saying, you may be developed, you know, now you may be having to put 60% of your energy into that and only 20% into the others, but your goal is to, you know, to do the opposite. And you know, like we said before, you know, you may want to be a great helper to people who are sick and suffering. But unfortunately, your capacity now is limited. You know, all you can do is you know, put on some Acuracome or Band-Aids or, you know, give aspirin. You know, but if you say, oh, but I want to be a great physician, you know, really somebody, well, then you're going to have to what? Yeah, which, and go into residency, you know, blah, 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 you know, so, you know, 12, 14 years later. In the meantime, are there not lots of sick people out there who are suffering? Yes, lots of them. I mean, do you run out and help them? No, you can't, because you're training. But you know where your goal is. And that's important. You know, I mean, if you just use it as an excuse for our own selfish indulgence, well, that's one thing. But if you're sincere, you know, I mean, let's say you want to run a marathon, but you've only been running, you know, a mile a day. So do you sign up for a marathon? No. You have to what?
Train.
And how long is that training going to take you to get you there?
In my case, never.
Right. Or significant. There could be maybe, you know what I'm saying? And so, you know, you're training. And it could be a mile, 2 mile, you know, 3 miles, you know what I mean? And it's a developmental piece, right? But you know where you want to go to it. And that's what's important with this path. That's why in the Bodhisattva path, in Mahayana Buddhism, even at the beginning, you know, with all our narcissistic self-centeredness and our neuroses and our, you know, all this, you know, we vow to what? You know, may I liberate all beings. And that sounds, for some people, that sounds kind of ridiculous, you know, because you might say, what? You know, I can't even liberate myself from my own suffering, right? I mean, here I am vowing to benefit all beings and relieve them, right? But it's not. It's kind of pointing our life in a direction that we want to go. And even though, the immediate steps are very small, as long as they're always in the direction of, we are moving in that direction. So that's why, in Buddhism, in Zen and the other meditative traditions, one makes the vow, to become a Buddha. Right? I mean, talk about crazy vows. Right? Because a Buddha is what? Fully enlightened being, rid of all emotional afflictions, all thought forms have all been disappeared, all karma is used up, right? And has the capacity to liberate countless beings, right? It seems so far away for so many of us. But again, because of the nature of the way Buddhist psychology views the mind, there is a belief that any intention, any seed in the mind that is planted and watered on a continual basis will grow at some point and will come to fruition. So that's why even at the beginning of practice, one can set the vow and the intention to become a Buddha. And you know, as long as one nurtures that hour after hour, day after day, lifetime after lifetime, if you believe it, it will grow, because that's the power of intention. Get it? Good. Anything? Yes?
I found it interesting, sort of both helping myself as well as being there for someone else seemed to happen simultaneously around a practice area for me, which is kind of guarding my time. And when somebody asks me to do something, or I think someone's talking a lot and I need to get to something else, you know, I tend to feel this resistance in my mind or sometimes say no to things. And so what I practiced doing was just, you know, dropping that. I mean, it's not as if I was saying yes to something I never otherwise do. They were all little things that, you know, weren't asking anything significant of me, just to really listen to somebody and drop that impatience, or to say yes to help out in a small way instead of thinking, but I need to do this and that. And so what I found was, once I just started doing that, it was very liberating to drop that resistance in me, at the same time that I was being it for somebody else. So it was really a wonderful practice to do that, and it wasn't just something, I mean, I was doing it to be there for the other person, but it did an awful lot for me too.
So this is the other side of that, which is when we are in situations, don't resist them, but be open. And don't think that there is something more important to do. Because the truth is, there is never anything more important to do than what we're doing right now. So we have a few minutes. We only have a few minutes, so let's do a small one. Can you see this one? This is a profound teaching. Again, the idea behind a pith teaching is that it is small, but in the seed, in the pit, there is the tree. The full capacity is present, even though it is small. So, smile, one word, is a very powerful teaching, again, I think on multi-levels. I mean, Thich Nhat Hanh got into the smile thing, not only because, you know, that on many Buddha images, you see there is what's called a half smile. It's not a big smile. But it's a small smile that's very characteristic of the way Buddhas are represented iconographically. He read somewhere that when, I don't know, but somebody probably remembers this better than me, I haven't really read it in a while, but some kind of, when you smile, I don't know, 14,000 facial muscles relax. I don't know. Does anybody remember that quote? I mean, it's something like that. So it's just that somehow just smiling, right, or just half smile, creates a kind of relaxed physical feeling in the body. So he felt everybody should walk around with a half smile. Really recommend that be the practice. Please walk around with just a half smile on your face, and that immediately introduces into the body a state of well-being and relaxation. So from a point of view of stress, from a point of view of physical well-being, maintaining a smile is something worth doing. And again, it doesn't... Can everybody just try it? And if you're embarrassed, close your eyes. So, you know, just try a little half smile. It'd be a big smile. And just see how that feels. You're kind of light and easy. You're relaxed. And things are okay. I mean, to me, the half smile is a mudra, a sign of just well-being. I mean, it's not like you're flipped out in joy, bliss. But you're not in misery, suffering. You're just kind of in a place of everything's okay. Everything's good. And you have that half smile on your lips. So it is a wonderful practice to have smile. But more than something that you put on your face, you know, like a good little coping mechanism or something, or one of those little things that kind of make life a little better, even though it's really bad. Well, some people play it that way. The half smile is the truth that, yes, in this moment, no matter what is going on, right? In the drama, in this moment, each of us have the capacity of being calm, relaxed, and open. And that half smile is the sign that we know that and we can generate that kind of energy. So it is very powerful. Because again, right now in this group here, does anybody have any drama going on in their life? You know, their own personal life, or if, you know, you don't have any real drama going on in your life, is there anybody close to you who's got some drama going on you could get into? So does everybody here have drama in their life to some extent or another, either in their life or close to them? And we'd all agree what? Yeah, we all have drama. And yet, here we are, right? And the drama only exists where? In our minds. It does not exist in reality. Right? It only exists in our minds. Knowing that, we also know that we have the capacity in this moment to not obsess about the drama, not ruminate on the drama, which is all self-created anyhow. So we're just repeating a bad story over and over again. And that we can relax, we can let go, and we can put the half smile on our face and acknowledge that in this moment, how is everything? Okay. This is the great contradiction of this life of ours, right? And some people don't... we think somehow we're betraying the drama, right? If we let go of our misery. You know? It's like things are miserable in the world of drama. And if I'm not miserable, right, and obsessing about the misery and keeping the misery going and repeating it over and over again in my mind and revisiting it over and over again and imagining it over and again, right, that somehow what? There's something wrong with me. But it's just the opposite. Right? Because if there is drama in your life, you know, in the life of your interactions, your relationships, you know, people around you, if there is drama, which means certain degree of what? Suffering, difficulty, then wouldn't it be better to relate to that drama, quote unquote, with a mind that is peaceful, calm, open, present, right? So even if it's really a big drama, a big suffering in your life, in the lives of people around you, right? Coming from that place of clarity, coming from that place of openness, coming from that place of calmness, love, etc., you know, allows one to deal with the drama, see the drama, transform the drama, or accept the drama, whatever it is, right? In a very different way than if we are caught up in it, if we become it. You know, how does that help anybody? I mean, how does more misery relieve misery? Can anybody give me an answer to that? It's a ridiculous statement, isn't it? And yet somehow we perpetuate our misery as if somehow it's going to what? Do something positive. It can't do anything positive. You know, there's one thing that's very true in Buddhism, you know, this is occurring because of that prior cause. Everything in Buddhism is, you know, if there's an effect, there has to be a cause, right? This is not a random universe, right? This is a universe of cause and effect, right? So how can misery create happiness? Anybody figure that one out yet? It can't. Misery can only create misery. Unhappiness can only create unhappiness. Right? So we have to make causes and generate things that will create happiness, well-being, calmness in our minds, and then it can have a different effect. Is that clear? I mean, it's kind of simple when you step back and see it. So, right? I mean, so a lot of times we feel, well, you know, everybody, you know, this person is, you know, this friend of mine or this child of mine, they're going through such a difficult time, you know. I talked to somebody a couple of months ago who's a mother and children, and you know, and when we kind of went, what was going on with her, because it caused her such suffering, she realized she had this belief, right, that if anybody she loved was suffering, she had to what? Suffer. And that somehow if she wasn't suffering, she was somehow not being a good mother. I mean, that's understandable. I mean, you know what I mean? But it's crazy, right? If somebody you love is suffering, you want to what? You want to be able to be there for them, to help in any way you can to alleviate their suffering. Right? Or the idea that somehow I'm at work and I know my son is suffering, so I need to suffer all day. Which is what this woman believed, that for her not to suffer, or actually a lot of it was around worry. You know, if she wasn't worried about her loved ones, that somehow she wasn't a good mother. Yes, Rick.
Could you say sometimes suffering or worry could lead people to actions to alleviate their worries or alleviate their suffering? It might be useful.
Well, I would. So the question is, could suffering move us to alleviate our suffering? I mean, Rick, that's the first response, not the 50th. Right. So certainly, that's what practice is about. I mean, you know, the Buddha said, what? I teach the cessation of suffering. That's what I'm here for. But I mean, how many times do you have to do it before before you take the remedy? Right? I mean, if I'm sick and I know I got to take the antibiotic, I mean, do I postpone it for a couple of weeks so I can suffer more? No. Right? As soon as I know I'm sick, I take the remedy. Because I don't want to be sick. I want to be healthy, right? So, yeah, I mean, you know, suffering is the motivation to practice, but how much do you need to motivate you? I mean, that's kind of a joke, but obviously a lot of people need a lot, right? You know, I mean, you look at the whole field of it. You know, in addictions and stuff like that. You know, when people, you know, in the addiction field, you know, where is bottom, right? I mean, you know, how much misery does somebody have to go through before they, you know, get it one day that their life is a mess? You know, I mean, and that bottom is what? The truth is, it's unknown, isn't it? I mean, you know, you think somebody's hit bottom and they pick themselves up and fall down a few more steps, right? So it's, but. At the end of the day, whether you pick yourself up on the first step or you pick yourself up at the bottom of the steps, at some point, if you're going to change, you have to turn it around. So I think it's much healthier if we can wake up to begin to acknowledge suffering for what it is, realize there is a remedy for it, that this is what the whole path is about. And so when we find ourselves suffering in all the ways we suffer, that we immediately name it for what it is, which is what? There is suffering in me. And begin to apply the remedies. Now the problem is that we don't actually, for a few of you who were just at the retreat, you know, we just did a 3-day retreat just on this very topic. To be able to name all the realm of all the emotional afflictions and neuroses and constrictions of mind and all the ups and downs of life and backs and forth and gain and loss, happiness and unhappiness, and just call them all what? Dukkha. You know, and just to see that that's what that is. So whenever when life moves in that direction, you know, like the alarm goes off. You know, I'm moving into suffering. I'm moving into dissatisfaction. I'm moving into emotional affliction. Stop. See what's going on. Apply the remedy. Yes.
As someone who's practiced worry a great deal.
Uh-huh. So you're a professional.
I have practiced a great deal.
Yeah.
I learned that worry had to do with obtaining the sense of control when one wasn't in control.
Mm-hmm.
But there is planning.
Mm-hmm.
And separating the obsessional character of worry, chasing your tail,
mm-hmm.
from rational planning,
yeah.
is not such an easy thing to learn when you've practiced worrying a lot.
Yeah, but the point, what is your name?
Bob.
Yeah, so Bob's, you know, raised a very good point, right, which is, you know, in the world of reality, you know, of our day-to-day reality, our life, this relative world, some degree of planning is necessary. And our minds have that capacity, right, to kind of logically think of, we can think about the future, right, we can conceive it, and we can, you know, develop goals and objectives, and we can kind of set up a plan of how we think we're going to get there, right? And that's a function of the mind. And that's and that is a function, as you stated, that has no worry or anxiety in it. That comes afterwards. That's something we bring to it because of XYZ, causes and conditions. And if our minds have been conditioned, right, for XYZ causes, you know, such as you say, the need, you know, to control outcomes or whatever, we have just confabulated. We have, we've brought something into it, right, which is causing us disease, distress, emotional distress. And hopefully when we see that and can go through a self-awareness and a healing process that we can, you know, learn to what? I mean, one can learn, there's lots of good remedies at the psychological level, the coping, the behavioral, the cognitive level, right, to deal with anxiety and worry. But again, I mean, if you remember what I was saying in the beginning of the talk today, right? You know, impermanence, change, nothing solid, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, constantly going and going. That means what? There's no control here. And that's not because you've been defeated and giving up, but because you understand how that's just the way it is, right? I mean, if Bob was out there every day doing his rain dance to create get rain, and then he'd be doing his sun dance to create sun, and every day he was out there, right, in his backyard, right, going through all these things to control the weather, right? Wouldn't you, and just working very hard, right, and always, you know, checking the reports and seeing if you could just manipulate the weather to go the way you want, right? Wow, what a lot of work. Wouldn't Bob be happy if somebody came along one day and said, "Hey, Bob, you can't control the weather. You know, just let it go, you know, right? You know, sunny days, enjoy the sunny days. Rainy days, get an umbrella out. It's good for the plants, right? Wow, Bob would be like, wow, thank you. Right? All my whole life I'm trying to control this weather. Going through all this work. Right? Planning and thinking and just, you know, I could just what? Be with it. I don't need to know. Right? If it's a sunny day, I put on my hat. If it's a rainy day, I put on my umbrella. Right? You know, in Zen, and we'll stop now. In Zen, there is that wonderful, a saying, from the realized master who says, what is the highest truth of Buddhism? He says, what? In summer, I sweat, in winter, I freeze. See, there's no control in that, is there? Right? No control at all. It's just, you know, I'm one with all situations. Right? I don't hate the summer. I don't hate the winter. I'm not always resisting, and you know, yeah. And summer, what? I'm going to be hot. I'm going to sweat. Right? In winter, I'm going to be cold. That's just the way it is. So, letting go, letting go, letting go at the deepest level frees you of a lot of these kind of emotional afflictions that seem so, you know, so strong. So that's why, again, these wonderful teachings are so beneficial. Because, again, it's for us having the teachings and the teachers, it's just like that, you know, that all of a sudden somebody comes along and says, you don't have to keep doing it the way you've been doing it. Because it hasn't produced what you wanted anyhow. You know, it hasn't made you happier. It hasn't made you more peaceful. You know, why keep doing it? There is another way. There is another way. So we'll stop here.